This is Dana Lombardi speaking at the War College at the 2015 Celesticon. We just finished our talk on Waterloo and Napoleon's Last Army, and now we're moving 100 years into the future, where we're going to 99 years into the future, and we're going to talk about firepower in 1914 and how that dramatically changed the way that people fought, the way that we saw warfare, and how they dealt with it. Because, as we were pointing out, in the past, in Napoleon's time, muskets didn't have a very long range. Artillery wasn't as powerful because it's not firing shells, it's firing basically solid balls. And cavalry is doing its damage primarily by disrupting infantry, especially during its retreat, by pursuing it and making them surrender in wholesale lots. Because, again, the cavalry is only using maybe pistols at best, sabers, or some kind of sword, more or less. And there are a few lancers, but most of the cavalry actually is just doing it with swords. So you still ended up with like 20-30% casualties. You'd end up with 50-60% if a lot of captures happen, obviously surrenders. So that's when you get those higher numbers. By the time of the American Civil War, we know that firepower has gotten a lot worse due to the Manet conical bullet and the way that it expands and hugs the rifling inside the barrel, giving it a longer range and more accuracy. This means that infantry now can fire longer or as long as artillery can, as just the same distance, just as effectively. And cavalry's been basically taken off the chessboard because big horses are big targets, and the infantry can do enormous damage. And now something else has happened in the American Civil War because of that firepower potential. Muskets are very inaccurate. Ann and I love to go fire historical weapons. We do it out at Chabot firing range. And a lot of our friends bring out different types of weapons. Well, one of them brought out a black powder musket. Smooth bore, you know, ram it down there with a wad and try and fire. No one ever hit the target. It was like, 50 yards distance, and no one ever hit the target all day, okay? Fired it at least several dozen times. They're just very inaccurate. The ball goes God only knows where, okay? So that's why when they said back then, fire when you see the whites of their eyes, they meant at that range you should be able to hit something. Beyond that, it's going to be very difficult. So by the time of the American Civil War, guys are able to shoot at a fairly long range, including one of the most famous incidences is General Sedgwick, the Union commander in the Wilderness. You know, somebody said, you know, watch out for those Confederate snipers. And he said, well, they couldn't hit an elephant from this range after, and just shortly thereafter, he has a bullet put in his brain and he's killed by a sniper. So weapons became much more accurate. Firepower became more frequent, so you could load and fire quicker, more quickly. So by the time we get to 1914, we have machine guns, okay? We've got past Gatling guns. We're now with machine guns. We have now artillery that can fire miles in range and distance. And basically, you can also shoot where you can't even see where the rounds are hitting. So they had to create a system to basically help them direct that fire. And then even rifles. We have smokeless powder. Back in Napoleon's age, they called it the fog of war. Why? If you've ever seen black powder fired over and over again, pretty soon the entire battlefield is covered with smoke. You literally can't see because of this fog of white smoke. Well, with smokeless powder, even from the machine guns, you can sit there. You can't see where it's coming from, and you can get cut down by basically unseen fire. 1,000 yards away, 500 yards away. Trust me, if you've ever been out there, I mean, we're shooting at targets 50 yards, 100 yards. That looks pretty small when you look through the aperture of your rifle. So you can kill people and hit them at longer away, and you can kill them with more firepower. So what happens is, during the Russo-Japanese War, what do? They dig trenches. Okay. Now this is very different. During the American Civil War, how did they make trenches? They pushed the dirt up. They pushed it up. They didn't dig down, okay? You did got some of that, but basically, you pushed it up because that was enough.
Yeah, they made palisades and maybe had abacus.
And if they were really clever, they put a log on top so they didn't get hit in the head as they're shooting, as they're standing up there, right? Okay, but the reason they could do that is that piled up dirt, which eventually hardened, is enough to stop a bullet coming at 700 feet per second, which is like a musket ball, a Manet bullet. These rounds are over 1,000 feet per second, 1,200 feet per second. And the artillery is even faster, and they're bigger, okay, bigger than a 12-pound shell. So you can't do that. The only way to survive is the best way to be protected is to be invisible. So you dig down so that they can't see you. And they also can't fire through just a pile of dirt, because now they have to hit right in the trench to do the damage. But they don't get there immediately. Why? Because when the French, the Germans, the Russians, and the British all start World War I, they're not paying attention to the Russo-Japanese War. They don't think it's going to happen because it's just the Russians, it's just the Japanese, you know, and the Americans are reporting this, how serious we take this. We are going to fight much better than that. So in 1914, the first months of World War I, there's going to be a lot of fire and maneuver. A lot of firepower is going to come into its own, and it's going to change warfare completely in a way that no one could have foreseen. Because even had you seen some of these things and read about it in a Russo-Japanese War, the Boer War, and so forth, the British did make some changes to their army, but basically it's the scale. Because, as I had mentioned in our little break, Waterloo was fought between, like, basically 150,000 guys. Say 200,000 total on both sides. That's just one army in 1914. So, you know, the French have like millions of men in their army at that point. So you're not just fighting for a city, one town in France. You're fighting all the way from the coast to Switzerland. And the British are going to do the same. They're going to take up a huge area, and the German army is going to be trying to keep its right touching the channel, which it's not able to do. But the point is that they're thinking at a scale that was unthinkable during the Napoleonic era. It was even unthinkable during the War of 1870, when, again, armies are just like moving like amoeba around France, you know, trying to go here and there and eventually surround Paris. But there's not this continuous line of troops like is going to happen in 1914. And the first and most important part of that is there's more human beings. Food is better, medicine is better, more kids are surviving, and so you end up with populations that had just ballooned up in size, and therefore your armies could be much bigger. And so you're fighting with millions of men in your army, and no one had ever had experience with that. Nobody. So what I'm going to talk about is firepower maneuver 1914. The first thing I'm going to talk about is you've all probably heard about the Schlieffen Plan. Schlieffen was the chief of staff, which is basically the commander of the Prussian army, the Prussian headquarters of the German army, the German Reich. And he came up with a series of memos. That's all they were. There was no like massive plan where this division's going to be here, this corps moves here. That's not what he wrote. What he wrote was a series of memos that said, okay, if we go to war against Russia, this is what we're going to do. If we go to war against France, this is what we're going to do. And his plan, as you can see in this, are the lines. There's two white lines. He said by the 22nd day, we have to be here, and by the 31st day, we have to be here. Notice that Paris is back here. So they're not even near it. He just said that this is how far we're going to advance. Then what we're going to do, we're going to hold, and we're going to try and outflank them along the Oise River, O-I-S-E, Oise River. And then after we gather this and the French are trying to deploy against us and hold us here, then we're going to swing around Paris with a bunch of corps, and we're going to basically cut them off like we did and encircle it, as they did during the Franco-Prussian War, forcing them to sign another surrender, and that's going to be the war. Several problems with that. When Schlieffen wrote all this, the army wasn't big enough to do this. They didn't have enough corps. They literally did not have a big enough army. So when he retires in 1906, and von Moltke, not the one who was in charge of the army in 1870, but his nephew, okay, they jokingly call him the lesser. So he had the greater, Moltke the greater, who was the winner of the Franco-Prussian War, and Moltke the lesser was going to be trying to win and loses 1914. So Moltke the lesser ends up inheriting von Schlieffen's plan. And Moltke the lesser is going to get all the bad press, because he did not follow the plan. Schlieffen's plan would have helped us win the war, but he does not follow that plan. Well, he couldn't. He didn't have enough troops. So the first thing you have to ask is, why are you doing this? You don't have enough troops to pull this off. So that's one of the things we're going to explore here, is that on a strategic level, this is not going to make much sense. And if you look at the armies they deploy, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, very, very nice. The Germans put them in a nice little straight line. You can see that this sort of grayish area is what they actually are able to do. Notice that the marches are not perfect, right? They wander all over the place. They get down here, and they just almost make it to Paris, okay? And that's when the counterattack, the famous counterattack that the French do, stop the Germans and throw them back. That's as far as they could get in 1914. So, von Schlieffen.
I have a question about that. Yes. Looking at the plans,
yes?
Why didn't the Germans push closer to the channel and follow the black line that would have brought them behind Paris?
Okay, so this is in the West Point Atlas. You can see this huge. That's great theory, but you know, the bottom line is these are what Schlieffen actually wrote, okay? This is what they actually did. So they got kind of close to that outside line, but they didn't have enough guys. They truly didn't. They needed another two armies to be able to swing that far out and to touch the coast, okay? But they didn't even have enough forces to do this, which eventually they didn't do.
Didn't von Moltke, though, send, well, I don't know, send a whole army?
Three Corps went, yeah, when they had the problems with the Russians, right. He weakened this army, sent these corps east to try and stop the Russians. They did not arrive before Tannenberg becomes a victory, so they're not needed, so they don't do anything. So they're neither here to help this offensive, and those three corps are not back east in time to help with that one.
Right, that could have helped in this, though.
It could have, absolutely. Instead, he weakened his forces. You'll also see exactly why the Prussians, the Germans get stopped. That's one of the reasons that it happens. So let's just take a look at him real quick. Because there's a lot of controversy about von Schlieffen and his plan and what he's supposed to have said. So, 1906, he did these memos. Now, we've done the same thing. We have probably heard of Plan Orange and Plan Red and Plan... Okay, you've heard about this. These are plans that the U.S. Navy came up with in case we fight Britain. This is after World War I, by the way, we came up with these plans. If we're going to fight a war against Britain, Plan Orange was against the Japanese and so forth. Well, when guys, military stand up or sit around, that's their job, is to come up with plans and contingencies, right? So that's what Schlieffen was doing, is contingencies. If we have to fight Austria, if we have to fight Russia. So he had all these hypothetical strategies, and they had general proposals for the numbers of corps and divisions, okay? But they were general proposals, not an actual timetable, not a specific, this is what this army is going to do at this point, okay? The memos that they ended up using were primarily for attack against France, and also one against Russia, okay? And then his original plan invaded not only Belgium, but also Holland. Volker the Lesser did not do that. Why? Why did he not invade Holland? I'm going to go back one step, and I'm going to show you. In order to make this work, okay, notice that one army goes around Holland this way and then comes out, right? So just marching across Holland, this is the idea that Schlieffen had. Just ignore their sovereignty. Just march over. They're not going to stop us. We're just going to march over and say, sorry, you know, here's some payment or something. Okay. Even the Kaiser, Wilhelm, he gets a lot of, you know, bad press. But he said, no, we don't need to fight Holland also. Okay? Because what is the big deal? Do you really care about this little country? Yes. Why?
Okay,
so there's Antwerp and Belgium, but there is, where is the biggest single port in Europe even today?
Amsterdam.
In Holland. So if you make Holland your enemy,
you can bring overseas materiel into the German economy that would otherwise be blockaded by the Royal Navy.
That's right, because in 1914, 1915 through 1917, who's sending supplies to Germany through Amsterdam?
The United States.
And the Brits.
And yes, as Anne pointed out. That's another story. But yes, even the Brits are trading with Germany. So the Kaiser, and strategically, this is smart, we do not want to make Holland our enemy. We need Amsterdam because that's the only way we're going to get supplies, because we know we won't get them through German ports. Okay? So that's why Germany decides we're not going to attack Holland or just march through it. Okay? So his plan to go through Holland is, no, that's not smart. So Moltke the Younger succeeded Schlieffen in 1906 as the chief of the general staff. That means he's in charge. A lot of people say that Moltke the Lesser, we'll get into this in a little bit more, is just not the strong guy that Schlieffen is. Because this guy looked at Willy, you know, Kaiser Wilhelm, and he said, no, this is the way we're going to do it. So I don't care if you're Kaiser. You know nothing about this. You're just a pretend soldier, right? So Moltke the Lesser just doesn't have that character, that personality. And so one of the reasons Kaiser Wilhelm likes him to be the chief of the staff is he can push him around. Okay? So in 1906, these handwritten memos, that's all they are typewritten into better briefs by Moltke's staff. So this is where this big plan comes along. Okay, so obviously they're going to lose in 1914. So what happens? Okay, so after World War I, German officers blame their country's defeat. Somebody's got to beat it. It's not my fault, right? This is the guy that's blaming. You know why? Because he didn't adhere to Schlieffen's brilliant plan, and therefore he failed to defeat France in 1914. Okay, so the reason they can do this is Moltke died in 1916, right? He can't defend himself, okay? So these guys get a one-sided argument. Our officers say, this is what happens, and the British in England say, yes, absolutely, this makes perfect sense, okay? And so that's what has always been presented as this idea that Schlieffen's plan is brilliant, Moltke failed to execute it properly in 1914, and that's it. So he's not around to argue for himself. No one is arguing for him. Okay? And so what happens that Terence Zuber, who's an army officer who's in Germany and does his PhD, he decides to go investigate this by going into the archives and finding Schlieffen stuff. I talked earlier in my other talk about finding documents in boxes that hadn't been looked at for 200 years. You would think that this stuff has been milked the same way. Oh, no. Schlieffen's material, this is very interesting. I'm going to get into the points about what the controversy is all, but how do they find these documents? So these are top secret documents, and they should be in the archives, except that in World War II, the Royal Air Force destroys the German archives in Potsdam. Gone. Burned to a crisp. All this should be gone. His original notes should be gone. The typewritten notes that Moltke's staff typed up should be gone. Zuber found them. It's like, what? Where were they? So Schlieffen's daughters come forward after World War II to the new German government and say, hey, Dad left all this stuff with us. Would you like it? It's like, your father took home top secret documents that belong to the German state, and you're now just going to give it to us. Yeah. Okay, that's how it survived being bombed by the RAF in World War II, okay? There is a precedence to this, by the way. You think that guys taking stuff back home shouldn't happen? Stanford, okay? Stanford Hoover Institute. Somebody was doing research in there. Guess what they found? All of Joe Hooker's Army of the Potomac records. Because when Joe Hooker was replaced as the commander of the Army of the Potomac by Lincoln, and Meade came in, what did Joe do? He wanted to write his story. He wanted to prove that he was right. So what do? Hey, that wagon full of all the records for the past couple of months, I'm taking that. And he did. And then Hooker ends up in California at the end of the Civil War, okay, and he dies before he can write his opus. So Hoover's going, wow, look at all these Civil War records. I think we'll just stick them in boxes here. And that's where they sat for like 100 years until somebody goes through these boxes and says, what is this stuff? And guess what? They find it. So this happens more than you think, okay, in the days of paper, where somebody who's a general takes a load of this stuff. And so Schlieffen's daughters inadvertently saved his records. And Zuber found them now in the archives, and he's literally looking at the stuff that Schlieffen wrote by hand that were typewritten by Moltke's staff. So he's going, this doesn't say anything like the British are claiming or like all these German officers are claiming. So he wrote his thesis on this. And his thesis ends up becoming a book, Inventing the Schlieffen Plan. Nobody in academia is happy with this book. They're really unhappy, because what did he just do? He just undermined so many people's given attitudes as accepted truth about World War I and about Schlieffen and Moltke. So what he revealed is that there was a conspiracy by German officers to blame Moltke on their own failings. It wasn't my fault. It was, you know, Schlieffen should have been followed. Moltke's the idiot. He also, this is why he's so hated. Zuber then, that's bad enough, but then Zuber called out historians by name, British historians, in the book and says, hey, this is bullshit. Why are you guys buying into this? You have absolutely no historical evidence. You're just accepting what these German officers said because it fits something you want to have as your agenda, which that didn't go over very well either. So let's just say that for years there were back and forth bitter recriminations and arguments between Zuber and other academics that Zuber went to one extreme and said there was never a Schlieffen plan, which is not true. It was not a plan, it was a series of memos. And all these people who were saying that you can't just remove Schlieffen from the formula, which you can't, but there's this huge controversy behind everything regarding how the Germans opened up World War I.
But doesn't the Schlieffen plan gives, it's a pretty story, it's a silver bullet for both the, well, I guess you want to say the Nazis, but the German officers who are protecting their careers.
Oh, yeah.
And then also, it also makes a pretty story for the French and British, you know,
kind of yes.
Like, you know, the miracle, the taxi cabs,
yes.
The army there. So
yes.
We defeated this clever German plan.
If it's a fantastic,
it fits yes. Everybody well.
Yes, and that's another reason. It's easy to fall into that trap of because it helps us tell the story we want to tell, right? And Zuber's saying, the evidence doesn't point that way, you know? The guy was not killed with the candlestick in the den by the butler, okay? That's not the case. You know, he was dismembered in the kitchen by the staff, right? And everyone's going, wait a minute.
Well, that's not a pretty story.
No, that's not a pretty story. You know, it's like, and you just ruined my career as a detective, right? So that's what Zuber's doing. Anyway, so back to Mac DeMolka. As I said earlier, he was not a forceful personality, okay? He could be bullied by the Kaiser, which is the most important. He also didn't know how to play politics. When you get to this level of military command, you have to be able to play politics with the guys that run the parliament in order to get, you know, the money you need for things, if you want to expand the army, if you want new weapons, if you want to be able to train your guys. One of the big problems the Germans had also is that their cavalry was awful. Just terrible. In 1914. It did a poor job of reconnaissance and everything it was supposed to do. Why is that? They had maneuvers. The Germans ran maneuvers all in, you know, 1906, 1907, everything, but what did they not do? Massive cavalry actions, movements by big divisions. Because what happens when 10,000 horsemen ride across somebody's estates? It chews it up pretty badly. It trashes it. So the Kaiser gets this message from Baron von whatever and says, who's going to pay for this? Right? You're going to pay for this. Your damn army just chewed up, you know, my hunting grounds, you know, and I want so much money to pay for. So the Kaiser says, we're not doing this anymore. And Moltke says, okay, all right, I guess. I'm sorry. It's like, no. It's like, You're volunteering to help the German state by allowing us to use cavalry operations. So as a result, there are no cavalry operations at a large level. The first time they're going to figure this out is when they do it in 1914. Okay? So, the results are this. The pre-war Germany's army failed to prepare sufficient divisions to fight a two-front war. It's just that simple. It's not more complicated than that. He could have had a bigger army. They had the manpower. But he didn't know how to weasel more money out of the government. Socialists are a big part of that. And you would think, wait a minute, Germany has this huge navy they're building. Why couldn't they have more divisions? What do building ships give you?
Jobs.
And your union workers are employed. How long does a ship take to be built?
4 hours.
So, I like the idea of a navy. That's great. You know, let's build lots of warships, but another division of infantry? It's like, yeah, exactly. It's like,
Let's take our socialist brothers and throw them
in the sky. Let's throw them, right, exactly. I'll build weapons that'll never be used, but I'm not going to have more divisions, okay? And Moltke had no way to force that through or connive or politic it through the parliament. So Germany just doesn't have the size of the army, and Moltke knew that. He absolutely knew. We can't fight a two-war campaign here. Okay, so I said, yes, they could have had more. Why? Because in 1914, at the very beginning of the war, in August, they know, shoot, we don't have enough divisions. So what they do is they create 13 new reserve divisions in 2 weeks. Okay? 13 divisions in 2 weeks. And they rush them, mostly untrained, not enough officers, and not enough heavy weapons, but they got bodies, and they throw them into the battle around Ypres in Flanders. It's called the Slaughter of the Innocents, because these guys are not trained, they don't have the weapons, they're just, you know, linked arm in arm and going forward as human wave, you know, cannon fodder, literally. But they obviously could create it, because they did that in 2 weeks. 13 reserve divisions, they just didn't take the time to train them or equip them, which costs money, which don't make as much jobs as building a warship. Okay, so the reality is, there's Moltke the Elder, his uncle, who won 1870. This is also the guy who gave us the great saying, no plan survives contact with the enemy. In other words, you have to improvise. You have to think, because whatever you think is going to work is not going to work. You've got to come up with alternatives. What's your plan B? What's your plan C? You better be thinking about that, because if the main attack doesn't work, you've got to have something else. Okay, so we know that Moltke had far fewer divisions than what the Schlieffen Plan called for. In other words, he couldn't do the Schlieffen Plan because he didn't have enough troops. Moltke told the Kaiser it was too late to change strategy and apply most of the army against Russia. So keep in mind, this is like the August, the July crisis before the war started, and the Kaiser's sitting there going, you know, I'm getting a bad feeling about this taking everybody against France. What if we just hold against France? You know, what if we just go on the defensive and we send everything against Russia? And Moltke the Younger goes, oh my God, you can't do that. We can't change the direction of the trains.
We have these timetables,
right. Which, by the way, that all was contradicted by the head of the German railroads after World War I saying, that's nonsense. Like, trains go both directions. You know, I can get guys anywhere you want. I'm the head of the train department. I can get these guys wherever you tell me to.
He was insulted to say that his system could not have adjusted.
Yes, exactly. He was insulted. Okay? So, Moltke's gone. Okay? The Kaiser's in exile. So, no one's really contradicting these guys.
So, that means you don't, if you hold in France, you don't attack Belgium. That means you don't attack Britain.
And you don't have Britain come into the war. Strategically, that's much...
Maybe not.
Well... It may be later, okay, but you don't have them immediately come in.
Yeah, maybe, but who knows? It's one of them.
So, I mean, even if you allow Britain eventually comes in, the reason for them getting in the war is poor little defense of Belgium, right? There's no argument about that now. And instead, Germany is fighting the biggest autocracy, Russia, which nobody really likes that much, right? And is purely on the defensive in Alsace-Lorraine against the French. Okay, so that's what Kaiser was telling him, and Moltke the Younger said, we can't do that. All right, Moltke the Younger had a specific deployment, which of course Schlieffen just has an idea, and a specific operational plan for each army. Again, Schlieffen did not. But then he doesn't manage that. He has the idea, he gives them the orders, and he just does not then supervise these armies. They just basically go out and they're on their own, okay? Whether they cooperate or not is really up to each individual army commander. So, Moltke the Elder, winner, Moltke the Lesser, things are going to go pear-shaped, and he never does anything to fix it. Okay, so let's go and look at the French side. We know that the French have a thing called Plan 17, which implies, yes, there were 16 versions of it before this. Plan 17 is only finalized in April of 1914. Commander of the French army is Joffre, and he's the one who tries to get these orders out. Everyone's got to understand them. And what it is it's also not an operational plan. In other words, it doesn't tell them they're going to attack into Alsace and Lorraine. That's not the idea. All it is where are we going to concentrate our troops? And Plan 17 has the French stretch out further and further this way, because they know they've got a pretty good intelligence that the Germans are going to come into Belgium. And so originally, plan like 14 is right here, plan 15 is like this, plan 17 gets all the way out here. Had they had more time, they probably would have been plan 18, where they keep extending their left, in order to anticipate the Germans coming through. What they did not know is the Germans are just trying to hold here and putting most of their troops on their right. Okay? So again, this is misunderstood as that's the French were just going to blindly attack straightforward, and that's not true. It was just an assembly, a concentration plan. Okay, here's Joffre. As I said, it's a deployment plan, not an operational plan. Joseph Joffre was the head of France's pre-war army. He and his staff developed Plan 17 to cover more of Belgium, as I said, and it was only issued to the field commanders 3 months before the war. So how in the world would you get familiar with it? You haven't even done, a field drill, you know, or any kind of maneuvers. Okay, so he had no specific operational plan because his idea, and he said this to his commanders several times, I'm going to wait and see what the Germans do. I want to see what they do, and based on what they do, then I am going to issue orders for how we're going to respond, whether we're going to counterattack or what we're going to do.
So all this talk of Milan, bearing, going towards the enemy with bared steel, he's waiting.
It's a big yes. He's waiting. Now, yes, there was the cult of the offensive, but every army had that because they believe you can't win a war by just sitting on the defensive. You've got to be able to be aggressive. You have to be able to go on the offense. It's the only way you're going to win. And they also said you have to convince your troops that they want to do that. You know, that they don't have the Elan, and this is every army. They do, in fact, have that at a tactical level. But strategically, he's saying, No. We're not going to waste our troops. This doesn't make any sense. Why should we do that? Yes, they end up wasting their troops, okay? But that's not the intention because they don't think that's going to happen. All right. So how it all comes down is that, remember those gray lines I showed you? This is how the Germans actually come down. They fight some battles on the frontier. They smack the BEF, which immediately kicks off and runs away. There's no other way to describe it. French, weird name for British commander, but French, the commander of the BEF, basically loses his will, and his whole orders were, when he left for France, is do not lose this force. This is the only army we've got. You can't lose this. It's only six divisions, but don't lose it. So he knew from the two battles they fought at Mons and then at Lake Courtrai that if another battle like that and they're gone. They're just done. Because the German firepower is grinding them up so badly. So he pulls the BEF out, falls back all the way back here behind Paris, and they're out of it. So the French are desperately trying to stop the Germans as they come up. And what Joffre is doing is he's transferring troops from this area over to his left to try and gain the superiority he needs to stop the Prussians, the German army. Okay. Everyone's making mistakes. There's absolutely no doubt. They're all learning. They've never fought a war on this level. They've never fought with this kind of firepower before. They've never fought with this many guys. They've never, ever had this kind of a war before. So, yes, they're making mistakes. But who's learning the fastest from this, right? So, Joffre, the only reason he decided to do these big attacks is because Russia fulfilled their promise to attack Germany, because they all knew Russia and France are allies, and they knew that the only way Germany could put all the troops that they had against France is they had to weaken their eastern front. They had only one army there. And Russia promised to get as many troops into action against the Germans and cause pressure, which is what you had talked about earlier with them removing those corps. Okay, so the Russians attacked. If the French don't attack, he's not fulfilling his part of the bargain. This is all political. And if the Russians don't believe that the French are going to attack and let them do it all, they're just going to say, that's it, we're done. Okay, so to keep them in the war, they have to attack. All right? He also believed that the Germans would not integrate their weaker reserve divisions. Okay? Each side, both the French and the Germans, have what are active divisions, which are first-rate divisions that have their best troops, best officers. Their best troops and their best officers, and they also have more weapons, more machine guns, more artillery. So the reserve divisions just don't have the same amount. They don't have as much training, okay? So both the French and the Germans have this. If we go back, I'm going to go back real quick just to show you something. Nope. Okay, there's a concentration. If you look at this concentration plan, all right, there are reserve units, but they're back here. You see in the back all of these reserves? That's where the French have their reserve divisions, is back behind, to use as support, as used as filler, replacements, and to fill in the line where necessary. The Germans, which Joff didn't think they were going to do, the Germans have them side by side from the very beginning with active divisions, sometimes in the same corps, sometimes as a reserve corps that is just reserve units, but it's right between two active corps. So they didn't believe they'd do that because that means that they have more divisions in line than Joff thought they would have. So they already outnumber the French because they're using their reserve divisions in with their active divisions, okay? So Joff, that's why he thought they could not make a deep penetration into France and or into Belgium, and they certainly weren't going to go that far to the west, okay, towards the Channel. And if they did so, okay, so, all right, if they do that, the only way they can do that is by weakening their center. So if they're stretching everybody else here, it's like, ooh, we can hit them in the center. And that's what he decided to do, because based on his thinking, all logical, the German army is going to be weak in its center. So we can hit them at their hinge. That will stop this movement on the right, and we'll be able to stop the Germans. Okay, we know that that's not true, and that's where the Germans smacked Joff's army, because they were prepared for it. So Joff made fewer mistakes. Both sides made mistakes, and that's why Joff is going to win the 1914 campaign. Here's another aspect of that. He knew that he had to take, because it's desperate, and if he doesn't keep his army together and get the best guys operating his armies, his corps, and everything else, then, you know, they're going to lose. So Joff constantly visited his army. He was rarely actually at his headquarters. He was most often on the road with his staff, with key aides, by motor car, visiting corps headquarters, army headquarters. He ended up, during 1914, in that month of August, he relieved 50 generals. 50 got relieved, okay? Corps commanders, army commanders, division commanders, if you showed hesitation, if you showed like confusion, done, gone. I don't care if you and I went to school together, I don't care if you're my best friend, you're gone. And Joff did that. On the other side, Moltke left his headquarters in Luxembourg once. Otherwise, he was sitting there going, oh, I wish I got some reports. I wish somebody had sent me some information. He left there once, okay? After the campaign, after Germany failed to win in 1914, then 30 generals were fired, including Moltke. He failed. But it was after everything failed is when they fired them. By then, it's too late. You lost the campaign. It just shows you how both sides were operating. Okay, so one of the reasons Germany almost pulled it off is they had a huge advantage in aerial reconnaissance, okay? There was an aircraft called the B-1. And why this is so important is the B-1 was able to fly higher and farther than anything that the French or British operated in 1914. Why is that important? If you can fly higher, okay, no one can shoot at you, either with any kind of artillery fire, and any aircraft was very primitive. And although they weren't armed with machine guns, these guys were taking pistols and rifles up and so forth. It doesn't matter. Germans were up there going, you can't hit me. And number two, they could go farther, which means they could go and do reconnaissance further behind the enemy lines and come back and in real time tell their officers, this is what I see. There's a corps on the road, you know, because I can see how long, many miles it stretches out. Horses are, you know, remember this horse-drawn artillery. So all those soldiers on the dusty roads, all those horses, you can just look at it from the sky. You can see all this dust on the road and tell what size of a force is coming down that road. And they were able to go back and tell their officers. Unfortunately, why didn't that make a big difference? It did in a couple of cases, but they had no system developed to be able to handle this. Aircraft are a new thing, so there's no air operations officer. Today, we have intelligence officers who give briefings. And one of the things they do is we have signal intelligence, we have, you know, human intelligence, we have photographic, satellite, all this stuff is laid out by the intelligence officer. No such animal then. There was no way to integrate this. So a young lieutenant would come in from flying, and he said, here's the map. This is what I saw, right? And there's a major probably sitting there saying, okay, put it on the desk. That's it. You're dismissed. Is that going to get to the field marshal? Is it going to get to the general who's in command? Maybe. That's the problem, is that there's no system for handling this information from a new branch of the service. And it's only going to be the one that works for reconnaissance, and both sides will end up using it a lot. But in 1914, it's all too new. So a lot of these reports never get to the people that need to see them. Okay, so both the French and German first line divisions, they each had 24 machine guns. Okay, here's the French one, here's the German one. Okay, both sides, same. The divisions were just the same in terms of the number of machine guns. But only the Germans were able to use their machine guns for indirect fire. Yes, that actually means that they used them to shoot at things they couldn't see. In every German infantry platoon, one guy was trained to be able to call in indirect fire with machine guns. So Montgomery, who was a battalion commander in World War I, Bernard Montgomery, who becomes famous for his Battle of Alamein in World War II, they were hit, and this like a rain of shells were coming in on them, and they don't know where it's coming from. They have no idea. He said they'd never, ever been under that much heavy fire. Most of the guys are diving, ducking, getting out of the way, you know, trying to seek cover. And it's just because the Germans are able to basically, you can see how these guns are deployed. All you have to do is tilt it, and now it can fire in an arc. And remember, they're firing like 1,000 yards. So they're behind a hill or behind some trees, firing over it, and they're being directed by a guy who is able to tell them, go left, go right, up, down, how many yards, and so forth. So the Germans have a firepower advantage, even though they don't have a numerical advantage in the number of machine guns. Okay, here's the next one. Both sides basically have a 75 or 76 millimeter size cannon. There's the French 75, there's the German 77, okay? But the French actually had a huge advantage because their medium artillery had a longer range, could fire further, and it also fired a lot faster. This means you could put more rounds on the Germans than they could put on you, and this gun is well within the range of this gun, but not the other way around. So you're thinking, oh, the French have an advantage. No. The French do not have any heavy artillery in their frontline divisions. None. Zero. The Germans have a 105. This becomes the standard cannon in World War II. The Germans already have that. That is their standard weapon. And the 105 has a longer range. It fires just as fast as the 75 the French have. And more importantly, even though that doesn't seem like much, 105 versus 75, it's huge in terms of the explosive firepower. It goes up geometrically. It's not just linear, okay? So that it's more powerful, explosive when it hits a target than a 75. Erwin Rommel, who becomes very famous for the Africa Corps in World War II, he was a young lieutenant, ensign at the time, and they were in the woods, and they were shelled by French 75s because he was in this campaign. He thought for sure there were going to be lots of guys killed or wounded. His unit, this battalion, was under this fire from these French 75s, exploding in the trees above them. And when it was all said and done, boom, 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 right? No casualties. And he was amazed. Why is that?
Okay.
The French are using shrapnel. The Germans use high explosives. What happens when a shrapnel shell explodes? Where does the shrapnel go? If it's traveling this way, then the shrapnel's all going to go in the same direction the shell's going, right?
Yeah.
So even if it explodes over the target you're trying to hit, the shrapnel, only a little bit of it is going to go straight down into the target. Most of it's going to go in the same trajectory as the shell was traveling. Explosives, on the other hand, an explosive, which is just, you know, concussive power, where it explodes is where it's going to do the damage, okay? So the German artillery is going to be more effective. Okay, in addition, although both sides have, well, the French have a 155 millimeter gun, it's a very old device. As you can see, it's all solid, which means when it fires, this entire carriage pushes back from the recoil. The German has a recoil mechanism that allows the gun to stay on target. This barrel goes back, but it just realigns itself in the same direction. Bang, bang, bang. Boom, rolls all the way back, gets reloaded, pushed forward. The rate of fire is much slower, and the Germans have a lot more of these. And the entire French army in 1914, there's only about 100 of these. Whereas the German, every German corps on their active corps, not the reserve, have these guns. So this is huge advantage to the Germans. Better aircraft for reconnaissance, indirect fire for machine guns, heavier artillery, more of it, and a system to use it. Okay, so why did it all fall apart? I gave you all those advantages the Germans had. Even though they had 83% of all their divisions in the West, Germany was still outnumbered. Take a look at this. First line active, the Germans have 45 divisions versus 49 for the French and the 6 British that show up. They're already outnumbered. Reserve divisions, 23 to 25. The Germans do incorporate these in with these, so they have 68 divisions against these guys, okay? But still, it's not a huge advantage. And then you have your second or third rate guys who are territorial or landwehr or what they call ersatz. The French have more, and the cavalry is dead even, okay? So basically, the Germans, despite having 7 of their 8 armies, 83% of their divisions in the West, they don't have an advantage. Certainly not like the Soviets say you have to have to succeed in World War II, which is 5-1 for an offensive to succeed. They don't have that. And they knew that. Both sides knew that, which is why the French weren't worried and why Moltke is sitting there going, he knew he wasn't going to win. Yes. Okay. By 22 August, the 3 German armies on the far right, because remember, they have loaded the right, okay? And the French have basically spread out their army, and they don't think it's coming through Belgium. Initially, the Germans have 358 infantry battalions against 257 for the French. And the number of artillery pieces, 2164 versus 1120. 1,000 more guns. 1,000 more guns the Germans start with when they're going through Belgium. This is why that offensive is able to push forward and the French just keep falling back. They make those attacks I mentioned at the center of the Germans, not here on the left, okay? Because once they get battered, once they get hammered by the machine guns and the artillery, they stop doing those frontal assaults. They just stop.
Excuse me. How about supplied with the guns on both sides? The German right wing.
Yes?
How many rounds per...
Oh, how many rounds?
Yeah. Available.
Everyone underestimated how many rounds they were going to gobble up. This is pretty typical over a lot of wars. But most of the guns had a couple hundred rounds initially, and then there were supply trains coming up. Part of the problem, though, is as the fronts advance and as those horse-drawn guns move forward, all the horse-drawn ammunition columns are, you know, it's like, how do you catch up? So now you have to start rationing out how many rounds you've got left. Right? Until you get adjustment. And they couldn't stop. They couldn't afford to stop. They did it once, but they just simply couldn't afford to stop because otherwise the French would be given time to reorganize. Okay, so by 18 August, 4 German armies on their right had a 40% advantage, okay? 19 days later, as they keep going across France to Paris, the French, who had shifted all those troops from their right to their left, now had a 50% advantage. So the miracle... The so-called miracle on the Marne, how much of a miracle is that? Look at this difference. The Germans have an advantage of 12 divisions, okay, and on 18 August. On 6 September, when they in the French counterattack, they have a 20-division advantage over the Germans. And yes, your question about them withdrawing those corps, those 3 corps could have made a difference. But still, the French simply were able to, using their trains... using their interior lines, right? It wasn't the taxi cabs in Paris. It was all those trains they were able to take entire corps of French troops from their right and bring them back to Paris and deploy them in front of the Germans. So 3 weeks, 19 days later, the French had this huge advantage, and that's what stopped the Germans in 1914. Okay, was it even possible, therefore? I mean, Dana's saying, hey, you know, Moltke doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't. He doesn't keep in touch with his armies like he should, although they have advantages in artillery and machine guns and aircraft. They're just not using it right. You know, so is it all doomed? Is there no chance for them to win in 1914, okay? And I mentioned all those advantages, okay? But here's what happened, is that poor command decisions, ineffective cavalry, I mentioned those before, fewer divisions overall, and a lack of operational infrastructure doomed Germany's armies. In other words, they're going to fight a modern war, and they haven't worked the bugs out yet. They don't have a doctrine for it. They're going to develop that between the wars. That's one of the big things about Blitzkrieg, is they're going to figure out, what do we have to do to sustain and advance? What do we have to do to keep guys supplied in order to keep, once we achieve a breakthrough, how do we exploit it? In 1914, this was well beyond them. So this whole thing was a seriously flawed plan to begin with. And that is my presentation on 1914 and how firepower maneuver failed the Germans in France. Any questions, please?
Would you say, after all was said and done, that the critics of von Moltke the Younger were more or less correct in their assessment, even though their specifics were not exact?
Their assessment was dead on, okay? He was a weak person, not fit for the position he was in. He part of those, I mentioned the Peter Principle before, where, you know, you rise to the level of your competence. Moltke the Younger absolutely had gone over his head. He should not have been the chief of the general staff. He should not have been the commander of the German army, okay? But for the wrong reasons. They're blaming him for not following Schlieffen's plan, as though just following those memos would have succeeded. It's impossible. He was given an impossible task. In fact, when the Kaiser said, why don't we just go on the defensive and throw everything against the Russians, that had a much better strategic purpose, both whether the British actually came in or not. The bottom line is, initially, it removed the British excuse to come in immediately, okay? And maybe even into the war at all for months. So when the Kaiser said, let's put everything against Russia and just hold in the West, that was a much better strategic idea. And Moltke had been, if he'd been a stronger personality or been able to see that, he could have said, yes, we don't have the troops, we don't have enough of anything. But he didn't, okay? You got a question?
No, just kind of an observation that... kind of one of the one big, you know, what if you don't attack, if you just hold in France, because later on in the war, the Germans pinch off the Serbs, pinch off the Russians, pinch off the Italians, and, you know, again with the Allies,
yes,
doing coalition warfare, but it's like they say, okay, well, we got to attack the West, we got to take out France, but it just seems like it was, you know, rather half-hearted.
It was a very flawed strategic plan that was not based on any reality of numbers or political. You know, invading Belgium doesn't make sense. You know, attacking France and hoping to knock them out. This is what's crazy. Let's just go back to 1870. They won that war. They defeated France, right? So they know this. They know it. They surrounded a French army at Sedan, captured the entire army, and Emperor Napoleon III, okay? Then they go and surround Paris. Do the French give up?
No.
And in fact, they raise more armies, right? This is 1870. The Prussians know this because they just fought that war. It's a history lesson for them. So why are the French going to collapse in 1914 and surrender after a month? What sense does that? There's no historical precedents that show you the French are going to just roll over and quit. They didn't do it when you destroyed their army, surrounded and captured it, when you captured their head of government. They still didn't give up. So why are they going to do it in 1914? This makes no sense. It's like they're living in some kind of fantasy world. You know, the Germans are like, I don't understand. I don't know how the mindset developed. You know, they're worried about the Russians and the Russians becoming more modern and developing a better railroad infrastructure, which is all true, because then they could take this huge army that they're scared to death of and roll right across Germany. They couldn't stop it. Why that has anything to do with knocking out France when France doesn't have the strength to cross the Rhine and invade Germany, assuming it can fight through Lorraine and Alsace? They're certainly not going to invade Belgium. They're not going to do that. The Germans know that the French will not invade Belgium. They won't give the Germans an excuse to come in. So, again, it makes no sense.
The other thing that I was trying to struggle is that the Germans have everything to lose. They have Alsace-Lorraine to lose. What are you going to get? You defeat France. What do you get?
Exactly.
What does France have that you want?
No one was doing the cost-benefit analysis, right? What are we risking versus what can we get out of doing this strategy? Had they just gone against Russia, if they wanted to get territory, which is what they wanted back in the East anyway, you know, the Ukraine, right? Poland, all these things that could provide them with places to grow food, with minerals, everything else that they could get, and they could split that with Austria. Again, this is just classic bad strategy, bad thinking, and fantasy. Even had they won, whatever that would have meant, 1914, even if they couldn't capture Paris, they knew they weren't going to capture a city that large with that many forts surrounding it.
Well, but there was, across Europe, a mass hysteria in the population at large, just overjoyed that this war had finally come. The people in all of those capitals, in France, in Austria, in Germany, even in England, they wanted this war to come. They didn't know what they were getting into, but they wanted this war. The German people wanted a war against France, and that is how they were able to sign up millions of people. That's how the French signed up millions of people. There was not a draft in the 1914 and 1915. These people came forward by the millions at the prospect of a war with France.
It's a support for what you're saying, and I disagree on one level, but I'll tell you what supports that, okay? Is that the unions, the trade unions before the war, had their internationals, their meetings, okay? And all the unionists said, the socialists all said, we're not going to have a major war because the workers won't support it. We will have loyalty to our fellow workers. We are not going to go into this thing and slaughter each other, okay? What happened, what they found out, is that nationalism trumped internationalism, okay? That when they thought a huge number of the French wouldn't show up at their reporting centers, right? They weren't going to show up for the reserve units and everything. They had a very low absentee rate. Most of them showed up. Ditto in every other country. So you're right on the level that nationalism absolutely trumped that, that people went out and supported the war wholeheartedly. Okay? And yes?
It also completely ignores the peace movement, which was extremely strong at that point. It was a very divided world. Yes, there were enormous numbers who thought the war would be a great idea, but there were equally enormous numbers who were sitting there going, are you people crazy? And including royalty and...
Yes.
People all over there were at least two international peace conferences before the war broke out.
Not yet. What I was going to say about disagreeing is that what Ann just pointed out is that they were shouted down. Those people who were against this and thought it was a bad idea, that, in fact, even Franz Joseph, who was the emperor of Austria, said, we won't survive a war. We can't do this. And he said, Russia won't either, because our rule, our control of our countries is very fragile. You know, if we end up in a war, it'll stretch our resources, our budgets. You know, we can't afford to do this.
If I think about it, I'm being kind of tough here. I see how the war benefits England.
Right.
I see how it benefits France.
Right.
Austro-Hungary, Ottoman Empire, Russia, Germany, all these people lose everything. I mean, they lose their empires. They go away.
Russia wanted the Straits. It wanted Istanbul. It wanted to have, okay, that's what it was hoping to get out of it. Yeah. Russia really wanted to have the Black Sea. The Ottoman Empire. They wanted just that Strait. Those are the Dardanelles, okay? That's what they wanted, okay? That's what they get out of it.
So I guess it's worth it for them.
Russia wanted to get rid of Serbia. Russia and Germany would have taken out Serbia,
right,
and that would have been it.
That would have been happening.
In addition, Germany is able to force France into a capitulation in 1914, they're not going to occupy France, but they are going to get concessions in French colonies in Africa. They are going to be able to force French and Belgian colonies to cede their control from Germany to give Germany the trans-African continental route from Cameroon to Germany, East Africa.
Right, it's not in Europe that they're getting the benefit. It would be if they had that kind of victory.
In addition, Germany has a closed economic colonial system. So, I mean, you might think that the United States is going to war to make the world safe for democracy. They're actually going to war to make the world safe for American trade.
Right.
That's William Appleton Williams a million years ago who said that. But all of those potential markets, if they transfer to a German-controlled model, all of those markets are closed to American trade and to British and French trade.
It assumes, however, that you can defeat France so dramatically
that they'll give that stuff up.
Right, that they'll give it up. And they don't have to. Again, they can just...
You get into a proxy war because who is building the Russian railroad to help them mobilize faster? The French.
Right, right.
You get into a proxy war where the French are going to let the Russians fight for them. I think they would have been very happy with that outcome.
So one of the reasons the British today, so many people are angry about them building a huge army and getting into the war and losing nearly a million men dead, doesn't include all the wounded who were so badly wounded after the war that they were just useless. We're talking about Britons today saying, why did we get into this war? What was the point? You know, what did we gain from fighting in this war? A lot of Germans were saying the same thing. It's like, we're already the dominant economic power. I mean, it's like, let's take time out to fight two world wars and get crushed. And here they are, 75 years after World War II, after being crushed in World War I, being totally devastated in World War II, and they dominate Europe. And everyone's bitching about the Germans dictating, you know, economic terms to them. It's like, they won, you know? Whoops, two little wars in the meantime, you know, sideline, now they're dictating it. Greece, we're gonna punish you. You know, Spain, we're going to punish you. Everybody else is going to have to do what we say. And Britain and France are going, well, we don't want to, but we don't know any alternative. You know, so I think you're right about it. Somebody sat back with any kind of strategic vision, instead of the Kaiser Willy, who's once the play soldier, you know, thinking that the glory would just wave the sword and go forward, right? And we conquer this territory and we'll be all glorious. Frank Chadwick said something very interesting. We talked about during the Napoleonic Wars the aristocracy, the nobles, who were in charge of everything just because of their birth. What was it? Who was the first British noble of the royals to won't go to college? Wasn't it married to Princess Di?
Charles.
Charles was the first British royal to go to college. Before that, they didn't bother. Okay?
Just tutors.
Yes, but, you know, they. How much would you apply yourself? You're gonna be king.
Yeah.
Why? You have to be smart, right? Really? And so, a lot of the royals and a lot of aristocrats in Europe were small-minded people. Very petty, not very big thinkers because they were never challenged to. You didn't have to think. All you had to be is make the decisions, right? And fill the position. So by the time you get to World War I, these guys are whacked. You know, in command of the armies, at least except for the French, that is not an aristocracy in the sense of, you know, royals filling it. Napoleon III was the last one. And they do have barons and everything else, but Joffre was not. Their army was not. These guys were all, you know, basically middle-class people, went to school, and you got to be smart because you're politically smart, which is still a very good form of intelligence. And you also had to know what your job was, and he showed that. Whereas a lot of the armies, including the German army, you know, you were an officer because you were a Prussian noble. Okay, Austria, the same thing.
And,
yeah.
And they were all related to each other. So they all, much of the aristocracy in Western Europe couldn't understand why the other people were so upset with their family politics. And they didn't view it that way.
Right, they just couldn't see it.
Yeah.
They literally couldn't see it.
If Queen Victoria had lived another 14 years, there would have been a World War I.
She wouldn't allow it. It's like her nephew was Wilhelm, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, no, you're not, Willie, you're not going to do this.
Her grandson. His mother was Victoria's
eldest. Right, okay, right, her grandson.
In fact, one of the things he said when the British went into World War II was Grandmama would never have allowed it.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. She just wouldn't allow it. Yes. So,
and we just don't think about that. That is how they look at it.
So the idea that, you know, I was brought up in the middle class. I was the first person on my father's side to go to college, right? Second generation American. So we think differently. To us, earning your way, doing hard work, you know, and proving yourself, hopefully earns you higher promotion, gets you a good job and everything else. Well, when you're born into it, you don't have to be smart and you don't have to be good. And there, the whole Europe was controlled by these people. And as Frank Chadwick was saying, it's like they're very small-minded, very petty, and they didn't have to worry about trying to learn this. It's like, just throw the guys forward, and if we kill a million of them, so what? You know, I'm still king. Well, that, of course, doesn't work out. Because for some reason, the people you're throwing away, the ones who survive, get really angry, right? And they throw you out, and then they shoot you and your family, or they just throw, you know, you have to run away to exile to Holland, like Kaiser Wilhelm. You know, it's like,
English breakfast.
Yes. So, I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, England, I don't know how it survived, but, you know, just barely, I guess, survived having its royal monarchy not trashed, even though it won, you know, and then after mortally wounding their empire in World War I, they made sure it was dead by World War II. You know? Yes.
I've heard the humorous comment that World War I was inevitable because Germany's recent history has been great cards, World War. Great cards, World War, and right now we're at great cards.
We're at great cards again, yes. No, they got rid of, the only way they could do it is by getting rid of their army, which they basically have done, you know? So, I mean, World War I is fascinating because it's as if the aristocracy of Europe all got together and had a row one night and said, oh, well, let's just all commit suicide. You know, and that's what, really, when you look at it, it's like, let's just get rid of our control and our dominance of European politics, and all of our houses, great houses, are just going to go away.
You were talking about the first talk about the general staff.
Yes.
You know, we had just Napoleon, and then here, this is a war where we have general staffs.
Yes.
And I remember reading somewhere about the German general staff, I think it was probably after the Franco-Prussian War, the Prussian general staff became German general staff. They're saying, you know, we're going to have to do a series of world wars, many which we may lose. Before we get to a point where we're, you know, the dominant power in Europe. And I just kind of was thinking about what you were saying about now, they got rid of the army, the general staff is, you know, more part of NATO than anything. And here they are calling the shots. Okay, if you want loans, Greece, you got to do this. Britain, when are you coming into the Euro?
Except for petroleum, Germany has most of the resources. France doesn't have ginormous coal fields. It's got some. You know, Britain has some, but the bottom line is Germany is an industrial powerhouse, except for petroleum. It doesn't have oil fields, right? And they also have finance and other skills that they were able to apply. Instead of their best and brightest going into the military, right? Where do you go now if you're German, right? You don't go in the military. If you're really bright,
insurance.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You go into finance or insurance or whatever, or international trade or something like that. So, you know, and it's
cars.
In cars. There are lots of cars, you know, great cars. So, you know, I mean, it's interesting, it's humorous, but the fact is, well, this war makes no sense on so many levels, and yet the only way to get rid of that power structure, to get rid of those nobles, they had to do this, you know.
Well, because, you know, just thinking about it, you get rid of all of them. I mean, all of them. The Turk, the Turks were kind of already gone. But
count the empire. Well, no, not officially. Okay, so the Turkish Empire, because the young Turks who take over still inherit the empire. That empire is gone. It breaks up into pieces.
The Austro-Hungarians go away.
Austria-Hungary's gone.
Russians
go away.
And the Germans.
German Empire, right? Yeah. France has an empire, but it's not an
empire.
Right,
yes.
Right. The only one that survives is Great Britain.
Well, the Italians.
But they're not an empire. Oh, that's right. They got a king.
They have a king, and he survives. Seriously weakened.
Cobbled together a monarchy in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, but yeah, they're not empires. Let's just say empires, great empires, okay? Not whether there's...
Like a Kaiser title or Tsar title.
Or you have to have the territory, too, okay? So
diplomacy of kingdoms, if you will. The ones that show up as characters, as players of diplomacy.
Yes, exactly. The ones of diplomacy. Right, there you go.
You don't have to worry about the Serene Republic, of say, San Juan.
Right.
Well, I guess the Japanese are still there.
Yes,
they're on the side anyway. So
the Japanese benefit enormously from the German withdrawal, because who do you think takes over the Pacific?
Right, they take over there.
So they're on the Allied side.
Yeah. Bismarck Islands, Marianas Islands, they take
all that
stuff.
They benefited enormously, and a lot of that was the result.
And they don't slaughter their people. Yeah, that's coming, okay? But in World War I, at least they avoided slaughtering their people, okay? So again, learning how to fight a modern war is tough, because even in World War II, even the guys who were there in World War I, Hitler was there, Churchill was there, Eisenhower, Patton, these guys saw it. And they determined, we're not going to do that again. And yet World War II kills more people than World War I. It makes World War I look like, you know, a rugby match, and now we have the real action, you know? It's like amazing that all this modern technology, which improves dramatically, tanks, better aircraft, better weapons, better artillery, better bombs, what happens? It just kills more people and more civilians. That's where the big change happens. When you lose 100 million people, like, what was it? Russia loses to 25 million of that, right?
We may never know. Between 20 and 40.
Yeah. It could be easily 200 million people. There's two sad things about that for World War II.
If you add the 5 to 15 million that Stalin kills on his own.
Well, they don't count because it's not warfare. That's just simply ethnic cleansing. Civil war is an ethnic cleansing story. But the bottom line is that there's something that's just appalling and also weirdly, you know, reassuring about this. And there's two things I want to say about it. One is that compared to World War I had something like, 5 million military deaths and something like 7 million civilian, okay? It was one of the first times civilians have always been hammered. Doesn't matter if it was Renaissance, ancient times, if your town was under siege or something, you're pretty much done. You're trashed, okay, as civilians. But civilians being a deliberate target really happens in World War I, where you're deliberately going to them where you have no chance to get their territory, but you're just going to like bomb them or shell them or whatever. World War II, it goes crazy. 200 million people dead, and most of them are going to be civilian dead, okay? Not just the death camps, which is a small part of the overall slaughter, but, you know, the number of people who starved to death, who were bombed, or, you know, all the things that are going to happen. Look at the people in Japan, how many people were killed, you know, through the bombing there. So, and so you're looking at like hundreds and hundreds of millions of people when you add in Stalin slaughtering the Ukrainians with all the other things that happened. Are we today running out of people on this planet? Didn't happen. It's like this trend. You know, here's the population. Ain't. That was World War I. Ain't. That's World War II. And then it takes off. So it's like we didn't exterminate ourselves despite these two horrendous wars and all those hundreds of millions of people who lost their lives directly or indirectly. Armenian genocide, you know, the Shoah with the Jews and the Gypsies and everybody in the death camps. You know, it's disturbing hugely to see that happen, and yet as a species, it's like blips on this continually upward slope of population. So it's like, even when we try to exterminate segments of our population, it's like you can't pull it off, which is thank God about that, but it's just awful that these things can happen and it does not impact the overall numbers. What, we have 11 billion people today?
Seven.
Right, it's 11. It's going to be 11. You know what? By the middle of the century. So it's just like,
well,
just like,
you know, if they run out of morning after pills today, SUV.
Yes. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. And what I'm going to do now is give out more goodies, and more freebies. I know everyone's anxious for that. So. First, if you have not taken one of these little cards up here, these are the micro game cards that Against the Odds magazine does. I encourage you to come.